difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it shaped our thoughts in a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Genevieve Kosky
and
Keith Phipps.
Tasha Robinson is off somewhere hating on Wally Brando, but she'll be back soon. On the first half of this episode, we looked at Babe, Chris Noonan and George Miller's sweet storybook fantasy about a runty pig who makes himself useful as a sheepdog. Now we turn to the new Netflix original film Okja from Bong Joon-ho, the gifted Korean director of The Host and Snowpiercer. In stark contrast to Babe, Okja is gigantic, a hippo-sized super pig that's been genetically designed by a giant corporation to serve as a delicious source of jerky and other pork products. Okja is the most spectacular of the 26 super pigs raised in various locations around the world, and the head of the company, played by Tilda Swinton, wants to take it from the Korean mountains where it was raised to New York City. But Mija, the 14-year-old girl who's been Okja's closest companion all these years, has other ideas. She goes on an adventure to bring Okja back home, which brings her up against Swinton and her minions, as well as a radical environmental group led by Paul Dano that wants to make an audacious point about animal abuse. Okja resembles The Host in many respects. Both are films about supernatural creatures born of American disregard for nature. But the film is its own strange animal, combining fantasy, corporate satire, and a surprising number of F-bombs. We'll talk about Okja and how it relates to Babe after the break.
Last week, we sent the 26 super piglets to the 26 countries where the Mirando offices are located. Each one was given to an esteemed local farmer. I have asked each farmer to raise their special guest, honoring traditional techniques unique to their respective cultures. My top scientists in the Mirando branch offices will be on hand to offer whatever support is required. These little piggies will be the ancestors of a whole new species. Mama Nature's gift. A revolution in the livestock industry. And now we have a competition!
So, Okja, what an odd movie. What did you all think of it, Genevieve?
Odd is a good word for it. I was really looking forward to Okja, and maybe I got my expectations a little too high because I enjoyed it, but I ran into the problem that I've run into with Bong's previous films that I've seen, Snowpiercer and The Host, which is that, like, the tone is just kind of a hard nut to crack.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to like it. I want to like the tonal mix, but it kind of prevents me from emotionally engaging with the film to the extent that I would like to. And I think that was less of a problem for me with both Snowpiercer and The Host, because I think that those films are doing something that is less reliant on an emotional connection.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the satirical point that Okja is revolving around is one that is really couched in emotion and your emotional connection to this animal and the girl who loves that animal. And the kind of whiplashing tonal style of the film, I think, kind of prevented me from feeling that emotion to the extent I probably needed to love this movie.
What about you, Keith?
I was into it. I think it helped to have seen Bong films in the past. In some ways, this is his most approachable film. And certainly, I think it's probably the film that will be seen by the most number of people. But
it
kind of feels like an advanced study for Bong.
Yeah.
But no, I really enjoyed it. And I don't know that the tone was, and the tone never felt all over the place. It just felt complex to me. I felt like we started with it from a fairly dark place.
We start from a very slapstick place, I think, with the Tilda Swinton's character, like, kind of introducing the whole concept of the 26 super pigs.
Right, but I think there's sinister undertones there from the beginning.
Yeah.
I think we get the wonderful scenes of Mija and Okja bonding, and which, you know, gets you into this relationship, and then it kind of returns to darker places, mm-hmm. or returns to places that were perhaps the darkness wasn't quite as evident before. It worked for me. It is, an odd mix of elements and performance styles, which I'm sure we'll get into. But I was there for the ride, and I found it quite affecting by the end. The slaughterhouse scenes and the denouement were such a lovely contrast, and I'm sure we'll get into this as well. But I thought the Super Pig creations were really masterfully made and emotionally moving, in large part because they're so animal-like. These are super pigs in the sense that they are genetically engineered, as you say, hippo-sized pigs, but they behave very much like real animals.
Yeah, except that Okja does cry.
Okja does cry.
Though, okay, tone is obviously the big thing here, and this gets me into the entire history of Bong Joon-ho's films, which I just wrote about for the New York Times' watching section, because 5 of his 6 films are available streaming right now for free.
Which one's not?
The best one, Memories of Murder.
Yeah. That's a good one.
But I mean, Memories of Murder is a perfect example. I mean, Memories of Murder is a very dark film about Korea's first serial killer, but it's also a lowbrow slapstick comedy. And those two elements exist side by side. And if you think about something like The Host, you know, there's a scene in The Host where a family is grieving over a loved one who's been lost, and it starts with almost this sort of tragic, sad tone, and then ends with them sort of wriggling on the floor comically. And that is not just exclusive to Bong, that is the Korean touch, to allow this tone to just completely lurch back and forth, and for you to just roll with it, you know. And that's not to excuse Okja's flaws or claim it as a perfect film, which I would not. I would not, in the Bong filmography, I would not put it near the top at all, for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned, Genevieve. But I find that there's been kind of an interesting, almost Kurosawa-like attempt on Bong's part to reconcile his national cinema, or at least New Korean cinema, with Hollywood, and with the Spielbergian touch, oftentimes. I mean, that if you're talking about like one major American influence on Bong, it would be Spielberg. Mm. You know, so you have this a director who very much appreciates effects-driven, family-oriented to an extent, fantastical, you know, filmmaking with a lot of nice reaction shots of people's eyes and extraordinary daylight special effects. I mean, all that is there in this movie. So I think it is not a perfect film. It is a rambling, shambling ride of a movie, even more so than his other films for me. But I kind of appreciated that quality about it, and kind of liked that sense of what the hell is going to happen next. It's a very surprising movie, and I for that I really appreciated it.
Yeah, again, I don't want to overstate my issues with this film, which I did generally enjoy, nor do I want to understate my understanding of South Korean cinema and the paradigm within that he is working within. The mix of tonal styles is definitely a feature, not a bug.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't know that it's like a feature that I wanted in this particular story. I really loved it in The Host and kind of in Snowpiercer. But here it didn't work for me more than it did work for me.
I could see that for sure. And I it's more disorienting than Snowpiercer tonally for me. And certainly Mother. Mother's actually pretty, I mean, I guess as straightforward a film as he's made, and a really wonderful movie. You haven't seen that one,
but it's odd too.
It is, and it's that one is about a mother whose sort of special needs son is accused of murder, and who kind of goes out of her way to exonerate him of this crime, and that movie certainly goes to some dark and discomforting places. But I really like just being in the space of a Bong production, just because they're so unpredictable, you know, and anything can happen. And he's very accomplished technically too, given the resources that he's been given here, which are significant, but modest compared to Hollywood. But significant, what is it, 50 million, 60 million in this production?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's the point of things like that chase scene. I mean, the chase scene is really the centerpiece of the film, but it is, I mean, obviously it's going to be storyboarded and choreographed, but it looks like, you know, a super pig cutting loose in an underground mall, and it's an amazing watch.
There's a studied sloppiness to it, you know, like just the way that the camera moves and like how you sort of see certain things but sort of miss others. And there's just like wonderful little touches woven throughout it. Like I love the girl taking a selfie video of being chased by this super pig, and like just the expression on her face, the way it fluctuates between terror and posing for the camera. Like, it's just, it's such a wonderful, just little grace note in a sequence that's full of those.
Yeah, and you could think of, like, a touch like that being so similar to, like, Spielberg shooting the approach of the dinosaur through that, you know, objects in mirror,
for
maybe
sure,
closer
yeah.
than they appear. So, you know, he's definitely a good student. And really my favorite moment in the whole movie, and maybe my favorite moment in any movie I've seen this year, is at the end of this scene where suddenly this John Denver song kicks in. It's Annie's Song, is that the name of it?
Yes.
Oh my God, it's so beautiful. It's so touching. And again, weird and unexpected at the same time. And you get this great close up on Paul Dano's face. You know, this animal has been injured. And like in this frantic moment, he is really focused on that and is affected by it in a very sincere way. I thought that was great. It's just something nobody else would really think to do. It's fun that it's out there for people to watch for free, I guess, if they have Netflix.
This is really the first time I felt myself thinking, well, I can't wait until this is on Netflix so I can watch it. First time I really felt like a real anticipation for something that was going to premiere on Netflix. At the same time, there really wasn't a moment when I didn't wish I was watching this on the big screen. I know it's playing on 35mm at the New Beverly in Los Angeles, and it's screening some places. But, you know, we live in Chicago, and there's no way to see this on the big screen. It's a movie that I always feel like you should see on the big screen is kind of a cliche. I mean, I've certainly had very powerful movie experiences watching movies at home, but, you know, given the choice, I'd always like to see things on the big screen, and we don't have it with this one.
We do not.
You know, new film from a major director, and it's not really playing theaters.
Yeah.
But as you pointed out, it's probably going to be seen by more people than any of that director's other films. So is that a worthy trade-off?
You know, maybe if you're some kid in Des Moines, is Des Moines my always go-to example?
Yeah.
And don't have access to these types of films, maybe you're struck by how strange it is and inspires you to see more films by him, and which are available, and other stuff you haven't seen before. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate.
No, you're right. I'm always a fan of anything that democratizes really great pieces of filmmaking or anything. I mean, for all the pros and cons of Borders and Barnes and Noble, like you could walk into the middle of a small town, and let's say Des Moines, or smaller towns that had a Borders, and you could pick up a copy of Ulysses if you wanted to.
Davenport, Iowa.
Blockbuster, the same thing, and maybe not the best selection, but you know, you can certainly get started down a road of watching interesting movies at a Blockbuster.
Like Cedar Rapids, for example.
Sure.
Cedar Rapids.
Yes.
So
Iowa is a very cultured state. You should stop.
I know. I don't know why Iowa's always my go-to example of people who don't
Let's say a suburb of Dayton, Ohio. A hick suburb of Dayton, Ohio.
What's the name of that?
Inglewood, Ohio.
Inglewood, where Keith is born or grew up, right?
Well, I mean, that's part of my story, but this isn't my podcast.
This isn't your podcast. So let me make one more argument in Netflix's favor here. There are two really big productions recently, this film and War Machine, which is less successful than Okja, but similarly unclassifiable. Not quite a satire, you know, not quite a historical document. It doesn't really work completely well, but it is the sort of thing that you can't put it in a box, that Hollywood would never go out of its way to finance for that reason.
And make a misleading trailer about to get people in the theater.
I was going to say, well, like, what if you made a horror movie that wasn't really quite a horror movie and had an odd ending that kind of leave people unsatisfied?
I mean,
that might fit on Netflix as well.
But if you're running a conventional Hollywood studio, are you really going to accept Okja as it is, with, because this is a film that is would appear to be for children, and it is about the relationship between a girl and her super pig.
It's really not, though. I mean,
no, it doesn't turn into that, but I think it could be sold as that, right?
Sure.
And it has elements of that before things kind of go haywire. But then it's got all sorts of F-bombs and
disturbing slaughterhouse sequences.
Mm-hmm. And it takes you to those places. And so I'm, you know, as flawed as it might be, and as really flawed as War Machine is, I am grateful that there seems to exist this studio, this strange little streaming studio that is willing to bankroll productions that don't really fit anywhere else. So.
For all my protestations, it's probably the future.
Now there's a poll quote.
And
for
I think everyone's going to be very happy when the next Martin Scorsese movie comes out on Netflix.
No,
first.
No, no. Okay, well, now you've gone too far, Keith. You've gone too far.
Not to get too far afield, but I mean, how many Scorsese movies would fall into that same category of difficult to classify financial risks? What if you made a movie about priests in Japan?
Yeah, I was actually just going to say, what if Silence had been a Netflix exclusive and people had seen it, would have had been a less wonderful film for
it
you?
It would have been really depressing. I saw that movie twice in a theater. I can't. Yeah, this is all too much for me to handle right now.
Thought experiments are fun until they start to
I know. And wasn't Scorsese's late next film supposed to be? Oh, yeah. Or is it Netflix? Okay, I'll get used to it. I've got months to get used to it. But let's go back to the actual film, Okja. Where does everyone stand if you talk about, you know, there are a lot of performances competing for our attention.
I was waiting for this.
In this movie. There's Tilda Swinton. There is, there's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yes.
Where are we at on Jake Gyllenhaal's performance in this movie?
I thought it was fun. I mean, I thought it was kind of Jake Gyllenhaal doing Jack Hanna crossed with Gene Shalit, crossed with Richard Simmons, and it's a big, broad, silly performance. But when it got to the darker, sort of, you know, more sadistic side of that character, it followed logically for me.
This is an unspeakable place. I know. There are worse rooms out there. Lucy Mirando says I'm not supposed to harm you in here. Well, at least not visibly. She wants you perfect for her big telecast. But when a woman humiliates a man in front of his own colleagues, a man is inclined to make his own decisions.
I think less so for me.
It's a divisive performance.
Yeah, it is. And it's not, I didn't hate it. It's not a performance I hated. It's a very showy performance, obviously. And it's a performance that aligns with the character, but I think ultimately kind of detracts from that character's arc, which I think is, I think that the Jake Gyllenhaal character and the Paul Dano character are sort of mirrors of each other, mm-hmm. and their performances really reflect that. Mirrors reflect. You get it?
Yeah, I do.
Paul Dano's performance is so sincere, I think, is the word you used mm-hmm. to describe that character, and it is not flashy in the way that Gyllenhaal's performance is. But I mean, those characters are both animal lovers who have gone astray in some way or another. Obviously, Gyllenhaal's character to a much grosser extreme, and mm-hmm. it's kind of ruined him as a person. But I mean, the arc of that character is that he is a naturalist of some sort who has ended up in bed with corporate farming interests, and it has eaten him up inside and turned him into kind of a monster. And I really like that character arc. And I think that Gyllenhaal's performance, while expressing that character arc, ultimately kind of detracts from the impact of it. It just goes back to my issues with the tone of this movie mm-hmm. that I think, while I respect the oddness of it, I think it ultimately takes away from a lot of my emotional connection to the characters and the story.
Well, and if you think if you want, I mean, I'm a fan of it too, because again, I'm fine with the film kind of jerking me around a little bit. But in contrast, Paul Dano in that whole element of the film is interesting because it is an agenda that is a sincere agenda, and people who are committed to animal rights and committed to exposing animal abuse, but who wind up having an agenda that is not Mija's agenda and not mm-hmm. not an agenda that's about returning things to their natural state or their unnatural natural state, I guess, since this is a genetically enhanced creature. They defy her wishes in order to pursue their own agenda, which makes them, you know, share a little bit more in common with Tilda Swinton and her gang than you might think.
I think also for all the outre touches that most people in the movie bring to their performances, the actress playing Mija, Anseo Hewan, and Okja herself are so grounded, and they kind of give it a still center in a way, and that grounds some of the madness going on around them.
Yeah, I mean, grounding it is one way to look at it. Being overshadowed by it is another, and I think that's just your mileage, maybe everything. But I mean, like, those scenes of Mija and Okja are my favorites, you know, and they do have that resonance that I feel is missing from a lot of the other aspects of this film. I slightly resent the fact that when I think of Okja, the first image that springs to mind is Jake Gyllenhaal screaming in a funny voice and not that beautiful connection between Okja and Misha.
I did sort of...
Or Tilda Swinton with a funny haircut, you know, either of those.
I did anticipate...
Two funny haircuts.
I did anticipate, you know, the movie being a different movie than it ended up happening just from those, that early sequence with Misha and Okja running around and being free. And then
beautiful.
I mean, you could picture this different movie that's just about them and the father and nothing else.
It's like a Studio Ghibli movie.
Happens, right. A Studio Ghibli movie where they go on little adventures and there's something great about another little favorite moment in the movie is when the father is asked, you know, what they did to make this super pig so incredible, and his philosophy was, we just let it run around. I love that. I mean, what a just a tribute to just a very natural way of doing things. So even though, again, this is not a natural creature by any stretch, you know, it celebrates that way of life and much the way that Babe does. So perhaps maybe now's the time to go to Connections. So we'll be right back for that after the break.
Oh, Johnny, you're skating on thin ice. Watch out you don't fall in and drown. Don't worry, I'm not here to put you to sleep with some corporate speech like my boring sister might have. Nope. I'm here to introduce you to a real superstar. Maybe you've already seen her on YouTube, enjoying her little shopping spree in that underground mall in Seoul. So let's all welcome an extraordinary little girl, a local farmer who raised her beloved super pig in wild and beautiful nature. The fearless pig rider from across the globe, please welcome Misha!
Now it's time for Connections, when we bring these two films together and talk about the things they have in common, Babe and Okja. One thing we could start with, I guess, is how both films reveal how we engage with animals and promote certain maybe vegetarianism or a consciousness about how we eat.
Yeah, I mean, I think Okja in particular is much more strident in its messaging around the consumption of meat. Babe definitely touches on it, but is a little more in the camp of like, this is how things work, you know, and we should be respectful of it, but it's the way that things work. Whereas Okja is really engaging, not so much, I think, with eating meat entirely, but particularly with factory farming and the eating meat is what sustains this harmful system of factory farming. What I really like about Babe's approach in particular is the acknowledgement that like, how you engage with an animal is all about the context. It's not about that specific animal or animals generally. You can have animals as pets. You can have animals as working animals. You can eat animals. And there's no universality of like, this is what animals are for, and this is how we should treat them. It's like we treat them based on the context in which we are engaging with these animals.
Yeah,
I thought Babe would create a whole generation of vegetarians. It kind of, I think it probably has had that influence in some quarters.
Well, you were just saying during the break that it made Cromwell a vegetarian, yeah, right?
Well, I bring in some extra textuals. Cromwell did become a vegetarian after making Babe because he felt like he couldn't honestly represent the film without becoming a vegetarian. And you listen to the audio commentary, and Miller's a little more where you're coming from, Genevieve, which is basically, you know, you could eat animals, but you need to be aware and respectful of what it is. And I'm not sure where Okja is coming from. I think, you know, the Animal Liberation Front, or ALF, it seems very much on their side. They're not a perfect vessel for the message. They make mistakes and they're deceptive. But there is that long post-credit sequence, kind of like setting it up for the further adventures of the Animal Liberation Front. And it seemed pretty on their side, at the very least, against factory farming, and as you say, the situation that it creates. And for all the horrors we witness in the slaughterhouse here, there really are just literally what happens in a slaughterhouse on a bigger scale. And it's kind of hard not to think about that watching this film. It didn't make me give up eating meat, which I was a vegetarian for a long period, and I'm not a vegetarian now, and I might be someday, but this was a movie that pushed me over the top. It certainly got me thinking about that again.
I can't necessarily fault Okja for being strident, because I think it is, you know, a satire among other mm-hmm. things, and it has its satires. They do have a certain point that they're trying to make, and it's a nuanced point, because I don't think you come to the conclusion watching the film that we mustn't eat meat, though I think we can be aware not just of the way animals are processed, but the way food, period, is processed. You know, and in terms of Babe, we can see that contrast between an ordinary farm, or what would be ordinary if the animals weren't talking to each other and behaving in weird ways. But really,
I mean, animals talking probably don't eat it. Right. Just good rule of thumb there.
Yeah, right. So
or crying.
Yeah.
You know, you could see them doing things, you know, the Hoggets are doing things the right way, in a responsible way, and in a very old-fashioned way. I mean, when you think about farms now, they're not the same. I mean, you have companies that own vast swaths of land or you know, harvest fish or pigs or what have you in large facilities specifically to develop them into food that is going to appear in your grocery store. And so to be a little more conscious of that, that I was happy with that message and kind of pleased in this context with the contrast between, you know, Okja and Babe about how we get our food.
Here's my thing. There's like a lot of arguments you can make against eating meat generally and factory farming in particular. There are a lot of approaches you can take to that argument, but I think they kind of divide into the emotional approach and the sort of logical approach. Like, you can make it a very convincing argument against eating meat based entirely on climate change and the effect that eating meat has on our planet. And that can also be very convincing. But the tack Okja chooses to take is the emotional one, which is that, isn't it terrible that we eat animals and how animals are treated? Mm-hmm. And isn't that sad? Isn't that upsetting? And that is a very effective argument to make. And depending on the person, it is the only argument to make. But going back to what I was saying earlier in this episode about like missing that emotional connection with Okja, I think that is sort of the fatal flaw in the argument or the satire that Okja is making, is that it is trading on this emotional connection to how animals are treated and their whatever the animal equivalent of humanity is. But the for me anyway, the tone of the film doesn't really support that.
Even the baby super pig at the end?
I mean, they're all very cute. It's also not real. Going back to what we were saying about CGI, you know, but like it all goes back to what I was saying about just the context with which we engage in animals. Like, we're sitting here with my dog Hugo, who I love and treat like a child. He is my pet. In a different context, if he was a working dog and I was depending on him for my livelihood, like our relationship would be very different. If this was the apocalypse and I was starving and Hugo wasn't my longtime pet and we didn't live in a society where eating dogs is frowned upon, I might consider eating him. I'm sorry, Hugo.
He'd eat you.
It's true. That too, you know? So like applying an emotional logic to just how we engage with animals universally, I think is fundamentally flawed in that regard, because it's all about the context, man.
Yeah, that's
I love my dog. I'm not going to eat my dog.
Yeah. I want to focus more on Genevieve eating her dog. It just went to such a dark place so fast. Very bong like of you to go off on that monologue. But it's a really good point. I mean, a lot of this discussion, this compare and contrast between Babe and Okja, is more about the contrast than the compare. I think you could see that Babe had an influence on Okja, and I think maybe Babe Pig in the City even more so, but a lot of it was just as a jumping off point to go somewhere else and somewhere a little bit darker. But I want to talk about some other places where the two films contrast, and that would be the time period and the setting.
Mm-hmm.
Genevieve, you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah, I suggest this comparison because I think it's interesting how both films kind of exist in a fantasy/storybook setting, but they do it through very different approaches. Where, as we talked about in the first half, Babe is kind of in like situated out of time and out of place and exists in this sort of like generalized storybook arena. Okja has a very specific time and a very specific place. Like it starts in 2007 and then the main action of the film is 10 years later in 2017 in New York City and Korea. And are there points in between?
New Jersey.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Like a place and time that is our own. And so therefore we know that this is an imagined story. It is a fable in a way. And so I think it's interesting how both films have that same effect of creating a sort of storybook fable atmosphere, but one does it through a highly specific time and place and one does it through a very vague time and place.
And then there's also the aspect where Babe is set entirely, almost entirely in one location that is that is very carefully realized, this little, you know, ecosystem. And,
a hamlet? Would that be a hamlet where they live? I don't know.
I'm not even sure.
A hamlet might be too metropolitan for where
they live. It's a little less populous. But and then, of course, Okja has got sprawl to it. I mean, you start in the Korean mountains, you're in Seoul for a pretty spectacular chase scene, then you go halfway across the world. So you get a sense that perhaps Bong and his co-writer on this, John Ronson, decided to just take a Babe-like fantasy concept and then just blow it up and put it in the real world and make it sprawling where the earlier film is really set in the one place. I feel it's jarring in a good way to throw this creature and this girl who's a fish out of water into a modern setting where they're off to the races. And it's just it's a shambling, tonally wild movie. But again, that's something I think is more to the positive than not.
Oh, and just another like little tangential connection related to something you just said. We talked briefly about Babe's relationship to modernity. Obviously, most of Okja takes place in modern industrialized world. But in the beginning, when it's Mija and Okja in their home, you know, in the woods, you know, they seem very removed from that world. But there are little touches of modernity that are in their life. Like when Mundo comes to the farm and she's like, retina display, you know, and they're watching TV and she knows who Jake Gyllenhaal's character is. Like she recognizes him, you know, like they are not completely isolated from the modern world. I just think that's an interesting touch that both films kind of have that little acknowledgement of modernity in the setting that is otherwise completely removed from our concept of the modern world.
Yeah, it does seem like the Korean equivalent of Hawkett's Farm, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
A place where time has not quite touched, but is still, as you say, you know, present in some ways.
And maybe, you know, there's a sense that Mija is a little bit, obviously she doesn't want Okja to go away and pursues her friend to the far end of the world, but she's different than her grandfather. I think she is a little more willing to embrace the modern than he is, and a little bit more, but maybe not to the extent that Tilda Swinton does.
It kind of sends her running back, though. Her taste of the outside world puts her in retreat by the end of the movie.
That is true. So one of the other things that these two films have in common is that they're a reconciliation of sort, or a collaboration of sort, between different cultures. They're international co-productions between Hollywood and Australia, and one and Babe, and then Hollywood and Korea with Okja. I was curious about what you all might think that signifies, because I had talked about it a little bit before earlier about how Bong is very Kurosawa-like and having an interest in both representing a very distinct national cinema and finding ways to square that with an equally strong interest in Hollywood. And Okja is, I think, a pretty significant step in that direction, just because so many people are going to see it. I mean, The Host was kind of the breakthrough, but this one has a lot in common with that. Babe, I'm not as sure about what the significance of that collaboration might be, you know, other than just Hollywood perhaps bankrolling, you know, a more homegrown production.
With Babe, I think it just kind of contributes to the sense that this could be any time and any place. And, you know, I think between this and LA Confidential, I don't think I really knew that James Cromwell was an American for a long time, because he's sort of flexible and there's no real, it's not like he's doing an Australian accent in this, but it's a little kind of an any place country accent in some ways. With Okja, the culture clash is kind of hardwired into the film in some ways. And I think that works in its favor. You can sometimes get with international co-productions, you get things like scenes shot just for the Chinese market in Iron Man. And I think these films designed to appeal across national boundaries are very much a part of a movie's future. And I thought it was gracefully done in this. And I think, as you pointed out, it is part of Bong's mission or approach of melding Korean styles and Hollywood styles. And you can't ask for someone better to put a bracing performance in the middle of the movie than Tilda Swinton either. You know, she kind of translates across borders and some interesting ones.
Oh, I know. She is the most, I didn't even think about that. She is such an, I mean, she's been in like a Bellatar movie. Mm-hmm. She's obviously in this thing. She's been in Hollywood movies like that.
She's played
like
an Asian character. Oh,
Michael Clayton.
I want to bring in the whole, let's not open that can of worms.
She's been with Jarmusch. She does. She is very much the definition of an international star. So I find it interesting that the difference between a harmonious mingling of cultures, or like the, you know, how we talked about Babe being like not particularly specific to any area or region of the world, and then, you know, Okja being almost like a globalist conflict writ large. Mm-hmm. So there may be something, you know, harmonious and exciting about the mix of styles and the mix of cultures from a cinematic standpoint. But the film is also engaged in how there's so much misunderstanding and a difference in values between nations. That was the subject of The Host as well, which starts with an American pouring formaldehyde down the sink and ends up in the Han River and creates this genetically enhanced a sea creature. So I think Bong is as interested as he is in American culture and in Hollywood, he's also aware of, you know, America's toxic influence on the rest of the world. So you can find Okja and Babe on Netflix. You can also find Babe on Blu-ray if you'd prefer to watch it that way, as Keith did, right?
I did, yeah. It looks great on Blu-ray.
So you can get that for a nice price, I think. Babe, Pig in the City is also on Netflix.
Gotta get that last plug in.
That's right, I have to. If you don't mind a little darkness in your family entertainment, I implore you to check it out. We'll be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Keith, what in the film world has been good for you lately?
I mean, I hate to just be the person like, here's the last Criterion I watched, but here's the last Criterion I watched. They put out very good Blu-rays, and that was They Live by Night, which is Nicholas Ray's first film based on the same novel that Robert Altman filmed many years later for the great movie Thieves Like Us. And this is, in some ways, a very different film than that. It's definitely more influenced by noir. I'm not gonna say more conventional film, but everything's more conventional than Altman's in some ways. But at the heart, it's still the same story of two people who fall in love and are doomed by criminality that they participate in, but also just sort of a system that's stacked against the people. Farley Granger plays this kid who's fallen into a life of crime. He's out of prison, gets right back into crime. Kathy O'Donnell plays his love interest, who's the daughter of a gas station owner who kind of puts them up. And they are sort of the first occasion of exacts an exorbitant fee from the thieves for covering for them, and which leads to the title of the book, they're Thieves Like Us. And it's sort of this world in which, like a lot of noirs, the whole system is corrupt and goodness and love is going to get snuffed out, but it's sort of lovely while it lasts. And it ends with this, you know, wonderful tragic ending, and it's beautifully shot. You know, it's in many ways a very different film from Rebel Without a Cause, but it would pair nicely. If we were doing some kind of podcast in which we paired movies, I would put them together, because there is this sort of sense of young innocence and a world that does not want to sustain it. And so I highly recommend it. And some really nice extra features on it, including a 2007 commentary that features a very late in life Farley Granger.
Yeah, I really, it's like a massive hole. I've seen really all of the major Nicholas Ray movies, but not this one, and which everyone loves, and which I know it's on Filmstruck now, or was on Filmstruck.
Yeah, it should be.
I have no excuse now. It's short too. I don't know what's wrong.
Short
with me.
And
what the hell's wrong
and
with me?
It's very much to your taste, as I understand it. And once again, the movie is They Live by Night, not to be confused with They Drive by Night, which is also a great movie. I'd probably recommend at some future date. But They Live by Night, Nicholas Ray's first film. Scott, how about you?
I want to recommend a film called The Rehearsal. This is a new film by Alison MacLean, a Canadian-born New Zealand director who hasn't made a feature since 1999's Jesus' Son. You remember Jesus' Son?
Yeah, it's really good.
Billy Crudup, terrific. Yeah.
It's got a great scene, an abandoned drive-in that's really stuck with me.
I know. I mean, and it was a really tough bar to cross because it was an adaptation of a Dennis Johnson short story collection, and it was acclaimed, but apparently it wasn't enough to get MacLean much more than occasional TV work. But MacLean returns to New Zealand for The Rehearsal, which follows a character named Stanley, who's a timid student entering his first year in drama school. And when Stanley and four of his fellow students are grouped together for this big end-of-the-year original performance, he draws on a public sex scandal involving his girlfriend's underage sister and her tennis instructor. The Rehearsal is a film with a lot of insight into the vanity, ambition, and human weakness that goes into the craft of acting. But for me, it's especially notable for Carrie Fox's performance as an instructor / administrator, which resembles in many ways J.K. Simmons' performance in Whiplash for its unsparing intensity. Fans of Jane Campion will remember Carrie Fox's Janet Frame in An Angel at My Table. She was also one of the main characters in Danny Boyle's Shallow Grave, and here her ferocious wit really just overwhelms the main character's extreme passivity and gives the film a spark whenever it needs one. So it's called The Rehearsal. It's much stronger when it stays in the school and deals with creative expression and all of the, you know, some moral issues that are raised. It's stronger there than it is outside of the school. But if you want to see something that's like Fame, but like realer, this would be it, The Rehearsal. Genevieve?
All right. Well, I've seen a lot of really good movies lately, and I came prepared with like a bunch of options in case you guys overlapped with my recommendation and you didn't. So now I'm left choosing between them. So I think
do them all.
I think I'm just going to do a quick drive-by of three movies that I really liked that you can and should watch. The first of which probably be no surprise to anyone who knows this group, but Edgar Wright's Baby Driver is in theaters.
Baby Driver.
And it is wonderful. I reviewed it for Vox. I loved it. It's a amazing kind of mashup of crime, picture, car, action, sort of movie musical. I've had a lot of debates about whether it actually constitutes a musical. And after hearing myself debate about it for a long time, I am of the mind that yes, it does. Mm-hmm. It does constitute a musical. but your mileage would vary. But it's in theaters now. It did really well in its opening weekend. It's probably going to be Wright's biggest hit. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't see it if you haven't already. The second recommendation I have is for The Big Sick, which is a new film from Michael Showalter, written by a comedian who I have loved for a long time. You probably know him from Silicon Valley, named Kumail Nanjiani. He co-wrote it with his wife, Emily Gordon, and it is an autobiographical story of their unusual romance and the circumstances that led to them getting together and almost not staying together. And then, well, I won't spoil it, but they get together. They're married, guys. Mm-hmm. But it's, if you like romantic comedies, and if you don't like romantic comedies, this is like the epitome of what a romantic comedy can be. And I think it's just like a complete validation of the form. The emotion on this movie is just cranked to 10 the entire time. You're either cracking up or sobbing, but it's such a wonderful combination, and it just translates to like pure emotion. That was probably one of just the most purely pleasurable film going experiences I've had in a long time. So highly, highly recommend The Big Sick. And then lastly, I want to recommend Logan Noir, which is the black and white version of James Mangold's Logan, which played briefly here in Chicago at the Music Box Theater, but as I understand it, is available on the Blu-ray of Logan. I'm really kind of into this new trend of like doing black and white versions of modern blockbusters. I mean, there was the Mad Max Fury Road, the Chrome edition, mm-hmm. you know, and now there's the noir edition of Logan. And I missed Logan when it came through theaters the first time. So this is my first exposure to it was seeing it in black and white. And at first I was like, is this like the best way to see it? And I really think it is the best way to see Logan. And I say that having not seen it in its colorized version, but it was really a great format in which to see the story for two reasons, I think. One, because it sort of served to separate it from the greater X-Men universe, because it does star Hugh Jackman's Wolverine and Patrick Stewart's Professor X, and like there is that connection to a long lineage of X-Men films that I think by being black and white and also being like a hard R movie kind of serves to separate Logan from that lineage in a way that I thought was very beneficial to the movie. And also, it's a really bloody, gory movie, and I kind of like my blood and gore in black and white. It's it's much easier to disassociate from it that way. So both of those aspects kind of contributed to me really, really enjoying Logan in black and white. So if you have access to the Blu-ray, I would definitely recommend checking out the noir edition of Logan, in addition to The Big Sick and Baby Driver.
That's a lot of movies.
It is.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen Baby Driver and can back you up. And, whether you want to classify it as a musical or not, it is certainly influenced by it and has a musicality to it that extends beyond the soundtrack. It really is incorporated in a much more sophisticated way than...
It's choreographed to music.
It is.
It's action that's being choreographed, not humans, but it's, I think...
And his performance, Ansel Elgort's performance, is so much a physical...
For sure.
Performance, too. What a joy. Pure filmmaking. Love it. And I'm looking forward to The Big Six and The Big Sick, I should say. And of course, Logan, I've seen twice, both in color. So yeah. I don't know of your black and white version.
It's a really good film on its own. We talked about doing it for the show, pairing it with Shane, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is
almost too obvious.
Yeah.
It kind of spells it out for you there.
I love that it can be in either form. It would make sense to be in black and white. And just it's so different than what we've been seeing from superhero movies and from X-Men movies. So that's a great thing about it too. So lots of good things to check out. And that's it for this week's edition of the Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out July 25th and 27th. Genevieve, what do we have lined up?
A car crash, a mystery, and a dreamy fantasy atmosphere figure prominently in David Lowery's new indie film, A Ghost Story, which premiered at Sundance in January to huge buzz, promptly got picked up for release by A24, and just reached theaters. Those same three things also feature prominently in Herc Harvey's 1962 horror fantasy Carnival of Souls, one of the great cult classic indie success stories. Both films deal with the unreal, unsettling experience of the afterlife, in the way the dead process time and emotion differently from the living. Both films play with simple images. A Ghost Story finds deep pathos in Casey Affleck wearing a simple sheet with holes cut for the eyes, basically a cheapy kid's Halloween costume taken to a serious level. And Carnival of Souls pulls a similar pathos from the spectacle of an abandoned carnival. These are films made on a micro shoestring budget, but they're both spectral, haunting experiences, if you'll pardon the pun. Our next pairing reminds us that filmmakers don't need much of a budget to do horror right. They just need to be able to create a convincing, moody atmosphere. We'll dive into the quiet terrors of the afterlife on the next Picture Show podcasts.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of Babe and Okja and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episode, where can we find everyone these days, Keith Phipps?
You can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000. You can find me at uprocks.com, where I work as the film and TV editor.
At Genevieve?
I am the deputy culture editor at vox.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Genevieve Koski. Scott?
I am on Twitter at @Scott_Tobias, and you can find my work in New York Times, Washington Post, NPR, Vulture, Variety, Uprocks, and one more publication I can now add,
Ooh.
The Los Angeles Times. I did a piece for them about Amanda Cornell, who is the Swedish Sami director of a film called Sami Blood that's quite good. And that was my first
You have not written the liner notes for any forthcoming film Blu-rays, though, have you?
Oh, that's right. Well, I think we mentioned on the show before, but by the time this drops, or close to when it drops, the end of July is when Lost in America is coming out on Criterion. So, of course, that is the biggest feather of all feathers in my cap. So I'm excited about that. And there may be another Criterion down the line.
Ooh. Watch this space.
Watch this space. So I'm pretty excited about that association, to say the least. You can find our absent co-host, Tasha Robinson, on Twitter at Tasha Robinson and at The Verge, where she serves as a movies and TV editor. You can stay updated on the Next Picture Show by visiting nextpictureshow.net, via Twitter at nextpicturepod, and via Facebook at facebook.com/nextpictureshow. And if you haven't subscribed to the show on Apple Podcasts already, please consider it. Apple Podcast subscriptions are an important part of getting podcasts more prominence and more listeners. And while you're there, we appreciate every rating and review. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keeps the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky for providing recording space at her home base, Genevieve Kosky's apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. You go to bed.